the Harbor Advisory Board, September 3rd, 2015. And I want to thank everyone for tuning in and coming. We do have a quorum. And I think the next thing is that I want to call a moment of silence. And then we'll say the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible,
So thank you. So the next item on the agenda is the chair and advisory board member time.
An announcement on Saturday, September 19th, in conjunction with the Echo Slow County wide shoreline cleanup, Morro Bay Beautiful will be doing its semi-annual cleanup of the north end of the spit. We do the south end as well, but Echo Slow says they're going to take care of that this time. And anybody who would like to do that, actually it's a really fun thing to do. We meet down at 8 a.m. at the parking lot next to the harbor office, and the Harbor Patrol is kind enough to ferry us over to the spit on the bayside. Then we split up and we pick up trash around the spit. We meet back at, Eric, what's the name of that beach I can never recall?
Sandals Cove, I believe.
Sandals?
Sandals Cove.
Sandless Cove?
Sandal. S-A-N-D-A.
Sandals.
I got it. Thanks. Sandals Cove.
Sandals?
Which is just about even with the trail that goes over to the South Jetty. And then we meet back there. It takes, you know, three-ish hours in the morning, and then the patrol ferries us back. So anybody that's interested, please join us 8 a.m. Saturday morning, September 19th, in the parking lot down at the Harbor Department, and we'll provide you with the things that you need.
Dana?
Yes, I have an announcement ahead.
Thank you, Dana. Neil?
I'll just add to Ron's bay cleanup on September 19th, if and mine.
Thank you, Neil. I have an announcement. We are going to be holding maybe the first or the drive-in surf movie night at The Rock. That will be on November 13th, 2015. It's going to be brought to you by the Friends of the Morro Bay Harbor Department and 97.3 Rock Community Radio Station. We have a movie picked out. It's not set in stone yet, but I hope everyone will put that on your calendar. Thank you. Lynn?
No.
Tom?
Yes, just to make another plug for the Harbor Festival, this year it will be free. We're going to have a lot of different seafood be cooked and served. It should be a lot of fun.
Thank you. And Gene?
There's a lot of life out there in the bay, that's what I'd like to say.
Okay, with that... is there any member in the public that would like to come and address the board for any matters that's not on the agenda? Bear?
Mike Rowland. You all know Michael. They call me Bear. Last time I was here, I was kind of complaining about what the criminal acts at the Harbor brought against me. They dismissed the charges. They gave me 6 weeks to get my boat ready and a $250 fine. And I have to get a permit by the end of the month. Right? Problem is that I work 5 days a week, and it gives me 12 days to do the whole thing. I have to move the deck and do a lot of repair work. I have a picture here that he wants me to do. 12 days is not enough time for me. I'm willing to pay the fine, but 12 days is not enough time for me. And other than that, I've got, let's see, the old engine off, and I've... got a brand new engine. I have to drill a couple mounts. I have to replace the whole back deck because I want to make sure that harbor commissioner understands that, you know, the strength of the boat is going to be back together. But I asked for a parlay with you guys between now and the end of the month, a meeting. Is that possible?
Say that again.
I'd like to have a meeting with the board between now and the end of the month about this. Is that possible?
Well, we're right here. I mean...
Well, okay. My problem is that 6 weeks is not enough, and the judge gave me 6 weeks. I've got the motor off, right? And I have another motor to put on there. I don't think 6 weeks is enough.
So 6 weeks from today or six weeks from...
I've already spent 4 days working on it on weekends, so I have till 30th of the month. Right? Now, I have two boats I'm working on. One that I need to put a diesel in, I have a diesel for. One that I have to put an outboard on that's registered to me in that has to pass the liveboard standards, which it shouldn't have a problem. I have everything but the motor. Now I have the motor.
Well, you know, I don't know really what the protocol is, to be very honest with you. I'm not real civvy, and I am sure that if you talk to the powers to be at the Harbor Department, Becca, or...
There's no way that I can talk to Eric or Beckett that we extinguished our communication. I wish I could say we haven't, but we have. I can talk to Keith, Officer Keith. Right? I don't know his number. I know that Officer 573.
So excuse me, Bear, why don't you let me talk to the powers to be, and yeah, I will personally get back to you.
Thank you.
Ron?
Bear, did I understand you to say that the judge gave you some amount of time? Did you use that word?
Yes, he gave me 6 weeks.
And who?
That's all that the city attorney, a Mr. Kwan, would accept.
And that's a judge in San Luis Obispo
County? Yes.
Okay. So this was an adjudicated matter?
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't know if this is appropriate, but how do I get a hold of you, Bear?
805. I don't care if the whole world knows. 952-3963. Morning, 810-135.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, and about the cleanup, what about down there in the riverbed where all those folks, the homeless folks have put buckets in that? I mean, there's probably a ton of garbage down there, too, by the park.
Okay. All right.
So
thank you, Bear.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Ron.
So for the 19th.
Excellent. Because it's bad. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Bear.
Good evening.
Okay, does anyone else here to talk on something that we don't have on the agenda? Seeing that, take a minute to look at the minutes from the Harbor Board meeting that was held on August 6, 2015. So do I see anyone?
We approve the synopsis minutes as written.
Second?
Second.
Okay, I have a first and second. Any comment? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Minutes are approved from the board meeting of August 6, 2015. Harbor Department status report.
So I'll start off with something not on the list. Councilman Matt Makowetsky, he's our liaison to the Harbor Advisory Board. At the last city council meeting, he requested a leave of absence from attending council meetings. He's had a pretty severe eye infection. He got some sand or something in his eye that turned into some weird parasitic bacterial infection, and he's got a patch, and he can't really function and do reading like he needs to keep up with council stuff, so he's asked for a leave of absence. So I don't think we're going to see him for probably at least a couple months, maybe up to three. So just want to put this shout out to that while he's not here in the audience, but we wish him well. On the list, Fish and Wildlife Warden change, formerly known as Fish and Game, which I usually end up calling it because I'm so used to it. Ryan Hansen, he was the lieutenant warden here that ran the Fish and Game boat Bluefin. He's moved on to greener pastures up in Roseville as a warden in the Osberg unit, which is the Office of Spill Prevention, and we're going on 6-7 years now. So seeing some personnel changes within Fish and Game, so we wish Ryan well, and welcome Kevin aboard as his new role here. running the fish and game boat. Recent city council action. At the August 25th meeting, city council approved the precise plan for the land redevelopment of lease site 124-128, which is the ex-Virgis Landing lease site, now known as Morro Bay Landing. Gene did a great presentation on what they're planning on doing there. This is the land portion. So phase one was the water slips that they've replaced now. Phase 1A, phase 1B is the slips in front of where the old bait docks are between Gaffco and Harbor Hut. That really bulldozing the entire building there, and Tognazzini's 3, it used to be the Thai boat restaurant. And before that, the fish boat. That all gets basically bulldozed. New building goes up, two-story, multi-level, pocket park where Tognazzini's 3 is, and then realignment of the road around through the corner there from the backside from the fish dock, because it doesn't really meet semi-truck standards, so that'll get realigned. So that's on track to continue on. Mr. Fowler had gone into Coastal Commission with the concept approval from the city. Coastal Commission wanted some changes to the architectural style. They wanted more of a maritime theme. Basically, the plans that Mr. Fowler had gotten from Verges were drawn up by pass-through Planning Commission, which they did a month or so ago, and then City Council again for precise plan approval. So the council did give that approval. That area, hopefully, will start development, and I guess maybe next year if the docks and whatnot go well.
Where is he going to go when he demolishes everything, or is he going to have a temporary structure? I mean, I'm just curious. Just, he's going to disappear? I mean...
Well, during construction, we have to demolish the whole area.
Right.
We'll probably have some trailers for, for part-time or something like that, and maybe work off the dock or something like that.
Yeah, the slips will be operational. The party boats will be operational. I'm assuming he'll keep that running.
Thank you.
Other recent events, August 4th was National Night Out at City Park. National Night Out started as, initially, and this is decades ago, as really a police department function to kind of showcase the police department, introduce police to the community. City of Morro Bay has been doing National Night Out for a number of years, informational items and just meeting and greeting the public. And then on August 18th, NOAA Fisheries was here, and they presented a quote-unquote entanglement response 101. It was an informational item for the public and fishermen. It's sort of a what to do if you see a whale entangled in fishing gear or any other kind of ropes or whatnot. And that was done here in, I think, up at the Wreck and Park Center, put on by National Marine Fisheries Service. Upcoming events, September 5th, 6th, and 7th. It sounds like this weekend, if I look at my watch correctly. Lots of different avocado-type things from our local growers and margaritas mixed in with the avocados. Morro Bay National Estuary Program is having their 20th anniversary party on Saturday, September 26th at Windows on the Water. They're inviting the public in to join the NEP to celebrate all the folks that have helped them throughout the years. They've got videos. They'll have a light bite and some beverages there, photo booth. Their nature center will be open, lots of other stuff. They've got a raffle, and really to recognize all the good work they've done over the last 20 years. It's hard to believe they've been here for 20 years. Coastal Cleanup Day, I think, Ron, you mentioned that earlier, September 19th, 9 a.m. to noon. Contact your favorite environmental or other public service organization to volunteer. Lots of opportunities out there. They try to get some of the creek beds. They get the beaches, the dunes, the sand spit, Morro Bay Beautiful and others. Morro Bay and Bloom are involved in helping out in different parts of that. NEP is involved in it. And it's just a great event to help clean up our beaches. Surfboard Art Festival is October 3rd. In various places, the folks that were involved in that. And finally, Tom, you made mention of the Harbor Festival on October 3rd. I'll just add that the festival is completely changing its format this year. It's moving down to Mid-Embarcadero between about Anderson Inn and probably Gray's Inn is where it's confined to. It's free. It's walk-in, walk-out freely at your leisure. Commercial fishermen are going to have several of the street ends cooking up good food and have their boats on display. We'll have some water entertainment, try and bring in and get the local businesses more involved, where in the past it's been at the north end and kind of isolating everybody out. We're getting the local folks in, and should be a great event. And it's just Saturday only. It's going down to a one-day format. So come on down Saturday and have some fun. And CMANC, California Marine Affairs and Navigation Conference, that is the industry representative group, one of the ones we're involved with. They're primarily interested in dredging and the Corps engineers and making sure the Corps engineers is working for California's ports and harbors, us included. I'm going down to Lafayette, or I should say up to Lafayette, September 16th to 18th for the fall meeting. The fall meeting kind of starts laying the groundwork for what we're going to do in Washington, D.C. in springtime. And it, again, it's really there to ensure the Corps of Engineers has the information and things they need from us and vice versa to get the funding for all of California's ports and harbors. I got a too late for publication. I got a notification from APCD, the San Luis Obispo County Air Pollution Control District. They have another $115,000 available to help fund repower grants for commercial fishing boats and other commercial vessels with diesel engines. So look to the APCD website or come to us in our office. We've got the woman who was attacked. Fortunately, she wasn't bitten, but her board had a big chunk taken out. We had another sighting yesterday of another large shark just right at the rock. We actually went back and looked at the surf line video footage, and you don't see the shark, but you can see when it occurred because everybody makes a pretty quick beeline back out of the water. It's fall. There's a lot of bait around. There's a lot of birds and whales and dolphins and seals. And, of course, the apex predators right along with them. So we put up notification for 72 hours. We get a lot of phone calls that people ask, when do the notifications go down so I can go surfing again? The notifications aren't necessarily meaning that the waters are, quote-unquote, safe or the shark's gone. It's really we put up notices for 3 days because we figure that's a good time, amount of time to warn the public that something has occurred. I keep using the analogy of going up into the woods, up into the mountains. There's bears in the woods, and you got to be aware that there's certain things you do and don't do when you're in the mountains when there's bears around. There's sharks out in the ocean. There's white sharks out here year-round. Fall, summer and fall is really our high season for them when we get large numbers migrating through. And you just need to be aware that there are sharks in the ocean, and you need to act accordingly. If you see a lot of baits, a lot of birds crashing on the water, a lot of sea lions, the hair stands up on the back of your neck. You know, people make jokes about that, but it's true. Your body senses that kind of stuff. And if you feel something's wrong. Get out of the water. You need to kind of, you know, be your own safety person there and act accordingly. But just be aware that there's sharks out there. So with that, I think that's the end of my report, unless there's any questions.
Thank you, Eric. Any questions for Eric? Ron?
Eric, regarding CMAQ, can you help us understand, or at least those of us that don't understand, and I'm one, a little more precisely what it is. I have the sense that it's sort of a lobbying organization that may be entirely incorrect. So could you help us understand what its mission? What's the mission of CMAQ, please?
Well, I wish I had the mission statement, but CMAQ is a organization, but it's really a trade group. Its membership is pretty much every California port and harbor up and down the coast, from the smallest, arguably us in Port San Luis, probably Port San Luis is the smallest, to L.A. Long Beach. And we go and work in unison through CMAQ to coordinate our efforts, again, primarily for dredging and Corps of Engineers funding, but they also address fishery issues. You know, we end up back in Washington, D.C. and going to our legislators and our regulators, and we go with a unified message where, you know, Morro Bay and L.A. Long Beach and Stockton and San Diego, all these ports and harbors, small and large, of all different colors, shapes, and sizes, go with a very unified message, and it's been very effective. And basically the message is you know, the revenues collected from all the commerce coming and going in California goes what's called into the Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund, and there's certain harbors that don't generate a lot of revenue into that fund, Morro Bay being one of them. We don't have any containers coming and going. But L.A. Long Beach, being the biggest container port on the West Coast, they collect billions of dollars a year that goes into that fund, but they don't take care of fishing boats. Morro Bay's and the Monterey's of the world take care of the fishing boats, and the Marina Del Rey's take care of the recreational boats. And so the message generally with CMAQ is that all the ports and harbors, and we're all, you know, cogs on the wheel, and we all have an important role. None of them do it all by themselves, do everything by themselves. We all have a role, and therefore they all need to get properly funded. And a lot of the funding that comes from California goes in the Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund, and we don't get all of it back to California projects. A lot of it goes elsewhere. So we're constantly trying to get the money that's generated in California back in California, as well as all of the money in the trust fund spent, because the money collected every year, total collected every year, isn't spent every year. And it really should be, and it could be. There's a unified voice trying to get our legislators to put pressure on the Corps of Engineers and the president and whatnot to get the budget in tune with the needs of California. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you, Eric. I think next here we have the Morro Bay Community Quota Fund status report. I think we have someone in the audience that's going to give that. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we've this was a future agenda item. I think we've been kind of a continuous agenda item about every year.
Right.
Quota Fund, I was planning on giving you an update. But Andrea Luker, the executive director, graciously agreed to come throw herself under the bus till she's here tonight to give you some updates and answer some questions.
And good evening. It's great to be here. Just to give you an update on the progress that we're making, a little bit of history tonight. Just a year ago, actually June of 2014, we actually started the quota fund, and that's when we finalized our purchase of quota or fish from the Nature Conservancy. They had to divest of some of their quota. Upon the purchase of that quota, the Morro Bay Community Quota Fund and the Nature Conservancy became completely separate. And one of the things that we like to continue to reiterate is that the Morro Bay Community Quota Fund is a separate 501c3 nonprofit organization not associated with the Nature Conservancy. Not that that's bad or good, but a lot of times people believe that we're still associated with the Nature Conservancy. We're still tied with them. So we are a separate nonprofit organization. When we purchased the quota from the Nature Conservancy, it was valued between $1.5 and $2 million. Prior to finalizing that purchase in 2014, we assembled a great, outstanding board of directors. And real quickly, I'll go through who those people are. We have Rob Seitz, who's a trawl fisherman here. He operates the South Bay. Janice Peters, a former active member of the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Association. Dr. Dean Wendt, who has probably perhaps been here before, but he is the acting director for the Center for Coastal Marine Sciences at Cal Poly, and his research certainly focuses on marine ecology and conservation. We also were super lucky with getting Dr. Bob Deacon. He just retired about a year ago from UC Santa Barbara. He was a professor of economics and environmental science and management, and he has over 30 years of experience. So he joins our board of directors. Of course, we have Eric, and I'm not even going to say anything about Eric because you know how wonderful he is. And then our board is rounded out with Ed Bacchus. And Ed Bacchus is from and lives in Newport, Oregon. He's the principal and founder of the consulting firm entitled Collaborative Fisheries Associates. He worked for EcoTrust for about 20 years, and he's also the founder and chair of the North Pacific Fisheries Trust. Rounding out the team, we also have hired Dwayne Oberhoff, and he works for us part-time. He has a company called Ecological Assets Management. It's located in Los Osos, California, our neighbor to the south, and he works with me basically on the day-to-day tasks of dealing with the quota and nymphs and making sure our quota accounts are accurate and we get the right fish put in the right accounts. Interestingly, with our bylaws, and they're pretty specific bylaws for a nonprofit organization, but we have committed to the triple bottom line, which you're probably really familiar with, but it basically deals with environmental, economic, and social benefits. And so real briefly, when we look at that, we feel like the environmental benefits are such things as sustainable fishing methods and avoiding overfished species. The economic benefits certainly are the importance of landing and processing fish here in Morro Bay, working in tandem with the city of Morro Bay for improving shoreside services, and then certainly looking at hopefully some innovation in observer methods. And then social benefits are, of course, providing locally caught sustainable seafood to the general public, to the local farmers markets, to our restaurants. As well as working to attract new entrants to the fishery, which is a big challenge, and then continuing education about the Morro Bay community. But the species that you may be familiar with include sablefish, petrolli, dover, lingcod, and numerous species of rockfish. During our first year of operation, which was actually June 2014 to December 2014, in addition to licensing quota or leasing quota to fishermen, we concentrated probably half and half on establishing the necessary policies and procedures that are important for a 501c3, not the most use of the quota that we have. Secondly, regional fishermen, fishermen that are in the California Groundfish Collective, which is a whole nother presentation and another day, but I always like to call the Groundfish Collective kind of an insurance policy where overfished species are, and if you're a member of the California Groundfish Collective, you can use those species as insurance if you happen to catch them. It's probably the best, simplest explanation. And then last but not least, if we can't license or lease fish to any of those three groups, then we'll go outside north and south to hopefully lease or license some fish to bring in some revenue to the quota fund. In 2014, so last year, June to December of 2014, we worked with four local fishermen and five others, and one of those others was an organization called Jefferson State Trading, where you actually list your quota online and fishermen bid on that quota. I like to refer to it as the eBay of fish, and we, through Jefferson State Trading, we ended up liquidating or leasing fish to approximately five other fishermen. So in 2014, we dealt with a total of 14 individuals for leasing our quota. In 14, we licensed or leased, and I apologize if I use those interchangeably. We're focusing on licensing because leasing connotes you have some ownership, so it's really licensing, but we're so used to saying leasing that it's training myself. So. But in 2014, we licensed over 1.5 million pounds of fish and just under 400,000 pounds to local fishermen, and that was June to December. In our first year, again, June to December, we generated approximately $97,000 in revenue, and our expenses were approximately $82,000. So if we jump to 2015, we're currently licensing quota to two local fishermen. We're licensing the majority of our whiting quota to an entity in Washington, and we did that last year as well. We have, I think, upwards of 1 and some change million pounds of whiting. And then at this point, we have sold to three other fishermen through Jefferson State. We're currently looking at our neighbors to the south, Santa Barbara in particular, and arranging some meetings with them to see if there's an interest in some of our sable fish south, because we have quite a lot of it that we're not going to be able to license locally or lease locally. As of August 2015, we've licensed approximately 2.1 million pounds of fish, and locally a little over a million to local fishermen. Speaking just quickly of our successes, I think, first of all, we're in the black last year, and we're looking good this year. It may not be quite as, it might be a little lighter black than last year, but we're still looking very strong. We're happy that we've got all the, one of our successes is our board of directors is a really strong group that are worker bees, not figureheads, which is really important in a fledgling 501c3, require us to allocate a portion of our revenues to scientific research related to the fishery. So what we did with the budget this year is we allocated $16,000 to science research. We put out an RFP in February. Eric put it on the website here for the city, and we distributed it. And the RFP was returned. We had two responses to the RFP, and our board of directors met, and just recently, a couple weeks ago, allocated $15,000 to a project that's basically going to survey the local marine protected areas to assess whether the fish abundance and size distribution has changed since the closure. And that survey is going to be conducted in conjunction with Cal Poly, as well as some local fishermen. And then we had $1,000 left, and we got a second proposal, and the board of directors decided to grant $1,000 to help fund a facilitator for the 2016 National Summit on Community-Supported Fisheries. And that was submitted by a gentleman named Joshua Stoll from localcatch.org, which is on the East Coast. And you're probably thinking, well, why in the world would we fund money for something that's going to be happening on the East Coast? And basically, we will have some fishermen participate in that summit, which is probably going to be North Carolina, South Carolina area in February or March. And basically what that group is trying to do is define the core principles of community-supported fisheries so the integrity of that concept is not damaged as that continues to grow, community-supported fisheries. So that's exciting. That $1,000 is going to be used for partial payment for a facilitator. We've also had three exchanges with fishermen coming to Morro Bay to talk about what's similar and what's different. And those fishermen came from the United Kingdom, Baja Sur, California, and most recently New England. And we're hoping to have some more exchanges this year. And then we've enjoyed working with our neighbors to the north, Monterey, Fort Bragg, Half Moon Bay, and Bolinas Bodega Bay for a number of different issues. And we're happy to say that the Monterey Bay has just, if they haven't, they're just about ready to finalize their purchase from the Nature Conservancy for quota, and they formed the Monterey Bay Fisheries Trust. We were the prototype for that of forming a similar quota bank or quota funder permit bank, and Bodega Bay Bolinas is looking at the possibilities. Real quickly, I'll touch on the challenges, because you can't talk about the successes without the challenges, and we have plenty. One is enticing new entrants to the fishery. And figuring out how to make it profitable for new entrants. The point is, we want to get people into the quota fund, we want to get them going, and then we want to push them on and get new people into the quota fund. So allowing the fishermen that we have to actually purchase their own quota, hopefully. So that's certainly a challenge. At this point, in terms of enough fish, when you think about, well, they have 7 million pounds of fish, it seems like an awful lot. A lot of those species aren't caught here, or they're not profitable. So we have enough fish, and I knock on wood when I say this today, we have enough fish today to supply the fishermen that we have involved in our program. If we grow, we're going to be able to get more fish. And we're up against a couple of challenges with that. One are species caps. You can only have a certain percentage of each species. And then there's an overall accumulation cap. And you can only have so much of all the quota. So we have some challenges there. And those are going to be, we're going to be, now that we're formed and up and running, those are going to be some policy changes that we're going to need to look at. You've all heard about the cost and availability of human observers, and that's another challenge that we have in order to pay for human observers. I think it runs between probably upwards of $600 a day for somebody to be on a boat doing human observing, so that's certainly a challenge. And then the challenge of educating the elected officials, the community, about the fishery, about questions, and I really appreciate being able to come and update you on what's happening with the quota fund.
Maybe not a hard question, just information. The Morro Bay Quota Fund, of the, I think, 2015, I think you said there's two local fishermen and four other fishermen that you obtained. Are those other fishermen fishing out of Morro Bay? I mean, just for my clarification, or are they ship fishing elsewhere?
So those...
How does that work?
So those other fishermen that we have now are fishermen that bought quota from through Jefferson State Trading. So they have a certain percentage. I'm trying to think back on what exactly they've purchased. They're fishing in this area. They may be fishing a little bit north, but they're likely not landing and processing in Morro Bay. And our push is to have it caught, landed, and processed. But if we can't have that, and if this is fish that nobody else wants, then we're going to go out for economic purposes.
I understand. Okay.
But great question.
Neil?
So it's a two-parter.
Uh-oh.
Easy one, though.
Is it hard?
Now, who determines the quota, and will it be negotiable?
The quota, the percentages change every year. So, for instance, last year we had, I think, upwards of about four or five million pounds of quota in 2014. This year we have more for a number of different reasons. But it's done federally, the percentages. So we could have more. We could have more, we could have less. I think anything is possible when there's not a lot of local control there. Likely we won't have a lot more of the species that we really want. For instance, sablefish north is something that if we had more sablefish north, we could get rid of it. We could get rid of it. Yes. Yes, you may.
Freely. The way I understand it, I think the simplest way to explain it is the quota fund owns a percentage of a given species that's allowed to be caught in a given year. And let's say it's 100 pounds and we own 50% of the quota, so we get 50 pounds. Next year they may decide, oh, it's only 50 pounds we're going to let you catch, so now we only get 25. So the poundage that we're allowed to catch goes up and down with whatever the allocation becomes every year, and it's based on scientific modeling and assessments, and they try and figure out what's the maximum sustainable yield and all these weird acronyms. So the poundage goes up and down. Our percentage stays the same. Is that a true statement?
Yes, perfect. Thank you.
Okay.
Annual determination is the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Yes.
Does the Morro Bay Community Quota Fund have an opinion as to whether the decisions that are being made on an annual basis as it relates to our specific area are based upon sound science?
You know, I will say that the Board of Directors hasn't specifically addressed that issue. I don't think that we feel things are completely out of control. But good question. I don't have a good answer for it.
And I have one more that's
kind of hard,
much less complicated.
Thank you.
What is a typical term of a quota license? Morro Bay Community Quota Fund license?
For a fisherman?
Yes.
1 year.
Thank you.
So one other question. When you said 1 year, I mean, being in business myself over the last 35 years, when you sign a license, generally 1 year, you're kind of getting your feet wet. I mean, why don't you, you know, carry it over 2 or 3 years? I mean, you know, the general rule in business, the first year you're trying to figure out what you're doing. The second year, hopefully you like what you're doing. And the third year, you better make some money. You know, simple math. But, I mean, 1 year seems awful short period of time to maybe derive the economic benefit that you could or should.
Sure, and that's a great question and a good point. First of all, it's a little bit difficult because our allocations change. So if I allocated 100,000 pounds of Sable North to a fisherman, but next year I only got 80, or if I had 100 and I gave 20 to some and 80 to another. So I think we have to be a little bit nimble with that and flexible. Our leasing policy that we put together, we looked at Cape Cod Fisheries Trust is an organization on the East Coast that's been doing permit banking since, I think, 2007. And we used a lot of their documents. And their licensing policy started off about as short as ours did. And it's grown in complexity because they've grown and had other issues that have come up. For instance, how long does a fisherman stay in the quota fund? Can he or she stay for 5 years, 10 years, forever? Is the point to kind of wean them off and move them on as they become able to buy their own quota and bring people, new people in? So those are all things I think as we go down the path we're going to have to address. We don't guarantee if a fisherman, for instance, the fisherman that leased quota from us last year, two of them still are, two of them are not for different reasons. The fishermen that are leasing, so, you know, it's an interesting kind of beast, and we're still trying to kind of rein it in.
Okay, I understand. Tom?
Yes. When you say north, you mean the 36 line at
Lopez,
I think it's, right?
Yes.
So if the fisherman was to catch the fish above the 36 line, let's say black cod, can they bring them back to Morro Bay to unload them?
Absolutely.
Okay.
To
unload. If they
yes, to unload.
Catch them
process.
Above the 36 line.
Yes.
If they weren't doing the quota fund.
Oh, I don't know that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't think they can. Since we own that quota, they can bring their fish back here to unload them.
Right.
Right.
Okay, Gene, you have anything? Lynn? Okay. Andrea, thank you very much. Very informative, and you're doing a great job.
The one thing I'll say, thank you very much. It was great to be here. I will remind you that we do have a website that we try to update on a regular basis, and we have a Facebook. I don't know how many of you do Facebook, but like us on Facebook, and that we keep try to have something every week or so on Facebook, so that'd be great. And it's, you know, kind of cryptic, Morro Bay Community Quota Fund.org on the website. Thank you.
Good stuff. Okay, next on the agenda is unfinished business. I'd like to hear an update from the Marine Services Facility Boatyard Ad Hoc Committee, and I believe that would be Ron.
Yes, in the interest of the haulout facility, I and another member of the committee, Dana McClish, attended last Saturday's Morro Bay Office of the National Estuary Program Estuary Update. The NEP office made a presentation regarding the health of the bay. I think that's my way of putting it. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and then as well as from the California Coastal Commission as it relates to eelgrass, got my attention as it relates specifically to the haulout facility, because the site that we're most interested in has some eelgrass in it. And even if it didn't, we might run afoul of eelgrass concerns. So I'm just reporting that. I would encourage, if Dana has a different takeaway, because he and I didn't discuss this actually before this, if Dana has a different take, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but if you have a different takeaway, then please, chime in. And then when we're done with that one, I have one other committee item.
I agree with part of what Ron's saying as far as how these agencies would probably react. Hearing this, the status of the eelgrass situation, it's pretty much gone. And what's left is where it used to all be in the back bay. Now what's left is in the nooks and crannies along the waterfront. And it's a very small amount. And then there's that couple beds that are straight off of where the T-piers are. And they were basically just presenting data from their studies that they've been doing and just showing the decline. However, they haven't done any studies on the tsunami event and the siltation of the back bay itself. And they did talk about invasive species that has come in and covered huge areas where the eelgrass would try to make its way through. And the other thing is the marine facility, as it is right now, we're working on nailing down areas, locations, when it actually is developed, things may be changing by then. We'll see what happens. The other problem with eelgrass is it really thrives with fresh water. It has a disease right now that is due to the lack of fresh water coming down the creeks. And we've been in a drought situation for some years, so hopefully that will change. Anyways, they presented what they knew from their data. And I think there's more studies to be done, and we'll just see how it goes.
Okay. Neil? Oh, I'm sorry. Ron?
Let me just finish my committee report.
Oh, I apologize.
Then you can open it up. The other committee-related item is best addressed, Eric. Relates to what the City Council is calling a mini master plan for the Triangle Lot, which is, as the board knows, is a prime target spot as far as we're concerned for the boatyard. Eric?
Yeah, thanks, Ron. So as you know, we brought this to City Council a couple months ago, and Council direction with GAFCO to see how a boatyard, maritime museum, and or parking, public parking might all fit in there. So I put together an RFP in early August, had a deadline of August 14th for submittal, had some deliverables, fairly short and succinct list of deliverables, and basically what we're looking for is for some design professionals to come in and consider the whole area a blank slate, and let's draw some things in and do some brainstorming and see what might fit. We got four proposals back in order of alphabetical order. Company Firma, San Luis Obispo, FTF, another San Luis firm, Oasis, in conjunction with another company, Gehring and Taylor, and RRM and San Luis Obispo, all provided for all proposals. All look great. They had various approaches to them. and obviously various costs. I had a $15,000 budget as stipulated by the City Council back in July, I think it was, and RRM came in at $9,980. So in addition to being the low bidder, they also had a great, pretty straightforward and quick two-week approach to it. They've also been involved with it before with the boatyard when we had the efforts a decade and a half ago. Up Coleman Beach area and up the Barcadero Dirt Extended area, they've worked quite extensively on that, so they've got a good running knowledge of it. So I'm working on a contract right now, hoping to get to RRM this week, which means really tomorrow at this point, and get that turned around, and hopefully in the next week or two at most, get our RRM engaged and start working on this. They are fully aware of working with the ad hoc committee and all the other interests at hand and trying to determine what's going to be the best use or have best layouts for that lot. And we're just going to bring in some of the planning and development folks from over at City Hall and the ad hoc committee and just have some good roundtables, and then RRM can go back and do some working drawings and see what might be possible in that whole combined lot area. As you know, if you've driven by there lately, you've seen a fence within a fence. Kind of looks like maybe the dividing line between North and South Korea. Now they've kind of got this inner fence lines are, the chain link fence lines are. Well, that wasn't exactly true. It was somewhat inside of that. We got conveyed the 2.12 or whatever acres it was. We knew the size, but it's actually a little smaller than what we had envisioned, but still a decent sized piece of property. So we're looking forward to working with RRM and getting that project kicked off here sometime in the next week or two.
Okay, Gene?
Yes. In looking at the request for proposals, it dealt just with the triangle lot. Am I correct, Eric?
No, we basically said the triangle lot, the Front Street parking lot, and all public areas kind of in and around between where, so if we build a boatyard, the obvious haul lot area is going to be somewhere between Stack's Wine Bar and the South T Pier.
When they worked for the proposal before, there was quite a few extras later on, and I don't want to see us tied in with a bunch of extras.
Okay. Just FYI, Gene, it was specified that it would be, by Mayor Irons, that it would be a comprehensive plan, not just the Tri-W, the triangle lot, I mean. And I would assume that's what we're going to get for the 9,000
adjacent kind of public areas, because it's going to affect everything. Obviously, if you pull out of the water somewhere there, you're going to come somewhere up through the Front Street parking lot and hook around. So look at it all. And there's not very many immovable objects. The wastewater treatment plant lift station, our oil, new oil facility there, utilities, there's a lot of underground stuff. There's not too much overhead. All that kind of stuff can get moved. We basically said ignore trees, ignore walls, ignore curb cuts. Just here's a blank canvas. How would you put it in here? Because all that kind of stuff can come afterwards.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Tom?
I received an email from Lisa, two other ports, I guess, what I got out of the email. They're thinking about putting yards in. And they were wondering if we need them to come and take a look at our lot.
I think it would
give us some ideas.
I think it would be wonderful.
Yeah, because they said they would do it.
Yeah.
Did you get that email, Eric?
No.
Mm-mm. It was sent to Henry.
Okay, I'll ask Henry to forward it.
Yeah, I definitely.
I'll forward it to you tonight when I get home.
Okay.
Okay.
I mean, that would be wonderful, Tom. Yeah. I mean, seriously. Yeah.
Since they're going to be here in California, they said they would come by Morro Bay and check it out.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, I'd like to get more information from the Travelist people, if possible.
Okay. All right, Neil?
Just coming back to Ron's topic of eelgrass, they won't look at, and by they, I mean NOAA, looks at the historical maps of areas. So they've every year they do ground truthing, so they'll drive their boat through with cameras that have imaging that can see eelgrass, and it can tell eelgrass species specifically apart from other type of marine grasses. Add historical data. They use NEP volunteers to go out and do ground truthing, meaning out. We've taken volunteers out, or NEP employees out, to go and actually count stalks of eelgrass, and so they have a pretty good historic idea. And what they're concerned with as areas, even if they don't have eelgrass now, they'll look at, okay, was that a historic eelgrass habitat? Could it be habitat again? So, because the species wanes, it comes and goes. And if we get a lot of rain this year and the habitat looks good, I mean, eelgrass could rebound as well. But
well, yeah, and I think that the whole intake of that presentation there is, it isn't an exact science. I mean, the bottom line is that there is only 13 acres of eelgrass in our bay now. 2007, there was 343. Mm-hmm. They, over the last 3 years, have spent a lot of time, effort, and money in taking seeds and samples from existing eelgrass beds and propagating it throughout the bay to no avail. It's not worked, and so they're not going to do that this year. They're actually studying, you know, different approaches. Sorry.
Yeah, the replanting, they weren't going to continue doing.
Correct.
Because they didn't have enough to replant. But they are seeding. They had
That's right, seed. They are seeding, yes. And seeing what happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was a good presentation, though. But, yeah. All right, any other comments on Ron's update for the Marine Services Facility Boatyard Ad Hoc Committee, please? Seeing none. Update from the Capital Improvement Planning Ad Hoc Committee, Neil?
So the first announcement is to better represent the scope of our work, we've changed our name from the Capital Improvement Planning Ad Hoc Committee to the Finance and Budget Ad Hoc Committee. And we met on August 14th with Eric at his office, at the Harbor Office, to discuss the city's cost allocation plan. As it related to our Harbor Department, and we determined that a meeting with Susan Slayton, the Administrative Services Director for the city, was needed to gain a better understanding and just kind of go through line items to understand the plan as it pertains to the Harbor Department. It's a large document, but the pages we're focused on are just for the Harbor. The meeting right now is scheduled for September 21st at 9:30 at City Hall, and we should have an update at the next meeting to go over findings from that meeting with Susan.
Thanks, Neil. Any questions? Comments? None? Next report is the Insurance Ad Hoc Committee. Lynn?
Shall I start over? The insuring agent for the city. And we met with them in order to get a better understanding of how the city insurance fits in with the risks that the committee identified, and which you had a list of those questions back in May, I think it was. To see if those points, those risks. Angel told us that Morro Bay is among the lowest in his region for having claims against the insurance. So city staff, city employees are really doing a fine job of managing risk in general in the city. And I think they deserve commendation for that. Of the 19 potential risks that were listed in that report, Mr. Angel said that those cause the Harbor Department is looking at ways to ensure or to mitigate risk, additional levels of mitigation, and whether or not requiring insurance from boat owners, all boat owners, or some boat owners who are using city facilities would be a good idea. And that probably would help, that additional insurance, if it were required, would then be named the indemnity would go against the boat owner and only secondarily to the city itself. There are problems with that kind of a program. It has been tried, or it was tried, in the state of Washington, and they found that they had to roll back, they had to backtrack on that. They could not carry it forward because too many craft were unable to be insured. In Newport, Oregon, they also tried to demand that kind of insurance and ended up having to evict some of their boat owners. I don't know if those were only fishermen or pleasure craft and fishermen. The other problem with this whole thing is that there are vessels that are either uninsurable or that the owner chooses not to insure. And very often, these are the vessels that could cause problems. So how can you do anything with those? Require insurance from everybody who can, but then you still have boats that were not well maintained and could not get insurance, then those would probably sink, self-destruct.
Disappear.
And it would discourage, and you could discourage boats that were potential risks from even coming into the harbor. So that was sort of our discussion yesterday, and I don't know if the conclusion is what one might want. Do you require insurance or don't you? Who, what kind of measures, and how would the ordinance be written? The fishermen's organization, or at least our representative, Alan, was also talking about self-insurance as a risk pool when I had discussions. So those would be very difficult things to add any mitigation through those measures. And the other and last problem in this is the sphere of control, since the city only controls a portion of the slips and moorings, therefore can only demand the insurance of some of those vessels. It's up to the other marina owners and wherever they are berthed to make additional rules and regulations requiring insurance.
Thank you. So, in summary, it's a quagmire.
Somewhat.
Okay.
But
thank you, Lynn. Couple questions, if I may. You made a point in the beginning of your presentation that the city of...
And, of course, the biggest one would have been the fire. The T Pier fire. We're paying back alone, $2 million because of the T Pier fire. And why that wasn't covered under insurance, nobody really knows.
Wow.
But it seems that facility was not listed under the assets of the city at the time. Mr. Angel said that we now are, no. Laurie and Eric said that the list that we have today is up to date, so should such a thing happen, it would be covered.
And that has nothing to do with vessels, so it's a moot point.
Because it was an electrical fire
caused by a
vessel that was tied to the pier. So it was, the origin was a vessel. Any other comments? Ron, would you like to add anything?
Just one small clarification. The state of Washington did not have to roll back the whole program. They found that they were advised that a number of older vessels were having difficulty obtaining liability insurance. It wasn't a matter that the owners refused to do so because the law was on the books. But they had difficulty, so they had to... They had to alter the provisions.
I misunderstood that.
Okay, any other questions for Lynn? Dana?
When you were talking about uninsurable vessels, Can you give some definition of what some of those vessels might?
Because I haven't gotten a description from anybody. I have an older wooden boat, and it's insurable. I can get P&I on it. But I don't know. I've been told that they can't. When I talked to a couple of the insurance companies, they only said if the value of the vessel, I take that back. I don't exactly remember what he told me. It was something about the value of the vessel. Maybe it was an insufficient value to warrant insurance, but I'm not certain.
Okay. The reason I ask is because I've had fishermen tell me that have wooden boats that they can't get insurance, primarily because they can't get surveyed here out of the water because there's not a haul out facility locally for them to do that. And what they told me was that because I cannot be hauled out where I berth my boat, they won't insure me. So.
Well, I can't haul out. I do not have a current survey, but I can buy liability.
I'm wondering if maybe it's a commercial vessel.
Perhaps. Maybe Ron can address this.
There are a large number of underwriters. It's what insurance companies call themselves. A large number of underwriters that have markets for commercial vessels and for pleasure vessels, and some both. On the pleasure side, these days, by that I mean in the last decade, the vast majority of those underwriters are general carriers, people that also insure houses and cars and other things. That did not used to be the case. It was a specialty market, but there was some big changes in the marine insurance world a decade or so ago, maybe 15 years ago. Those underwriters, those general carriers, all have different underwriting policies, every one of them. We conducted 2,000 or 2,500 surveys. Many of those were used for insurance purposes, among other things. And it's very important, and I think it, for the public, it's very important to understand that when we're talking about vessel insurance, and the board has addressed this tonight, but just to be clear, there's two different kinds of insurance. There's property insurance, insuring the vessel itself, and then there's liability insurance, or as Lynn quite correctly referred to it, P&I, indemnity insurance. So we're only talking about liability insurance. That's the topic. Whether someone chooses to insure their vessel, the property of their vessel from whatever risk, that's not what we're talking about. It's not the scope of the committee. All this started because the Harbor Advisory Board, and I know we all know this, but maybe some of the public doesn't know this. This all started because the Harbor Advisory Board became interested in whether a reasonable number of potential liabilities risks to the city devolving from the vessels that it moors or in some way gets involved with were adequately covered. That's what got us all started on this. And, you know, as I'm sure Lynn feels, in some ways we've kind of gone down a rabbit hole, but, you know, I think it was a good time. So getting back on point about underwriters, while they all have different policies from time to time, almost all of them will require some kind of due diligence documentation for vessels that are of an age or of a type. For instance, I don't know of a single general carrier today, but then, you know, there might be one. Okay, I just don't know of one, and we do a lot of business with underwriters, who will insure a ferrocement vessel. perceived as being too great a risk on the basis of actuarials over a period of time. They're not wildly enthusiastic, the general carriers, about wooden vessels, which one can say is really not terribly rational. You know, there's thousands of wood boats that are doing just fine. But if you approach them with a wood boat for liability insurance, the vast majority of them are going to want some sort of due diligence proof of condition at a given age. And 10 years of age is a marker. So if the boat is 10 years old or older, they're going to want some sort of indicator. And a marine survey is a very common requirement. And out of the water, obviously. The commercial folks, it's a different situation. The underwriting crowd tends to be more knowledgeable about boats than on the pleasure side. That's a generalization, but it tends to be true. So those underwriters have a different perspective, but they are still just as risk aversive as the pleasure boat people are. But older wooden fishing boats, and I mean from the 1940s or the 50s or much less the 60s, aren't generally just denied out of hand coverage. Again, there's going to have to be some sort of due diligence proof of condition. When I say proof, they're going to have to satisfy an underwriter, or more than one underwriter, that the vessel has, let's see, what does Eric like to say? That it's seaworthy. So it isn't impossible. It's complicated. But there aren't really very many boats. Really, you think about Morro Bay and our 500 boats. We've got whatever the number, 450, whatever the last census was. There aren't very many of them out there that are, I think, uninsurable. But as Lynn pointed out, and as the discussion went on earlier, those are the very boats that we're most concerned about. So I don't know that I added anything, but give you a little information about that, how the underwriters think.
So going back to point, we formed this subcommittee to make sure that the city of Morro Bay was covered as best as possible. So now that we've presented the facts and some background, what do we want to do with it? Do we feel that we're covered adequately or not? Gene?
You mentioned we, and I wanted to get a definition of the city facilities so I know what we're talking about. Are we talking about tying up to the T-pier? Are we tying up to a slip? Are we tying up to the side tie dock or an end street dock? I kind of need to know what facilities. Is the city of Morro Bay considered a city facility? I think that needs to be defined pretty accurately.
Well, I'll jump in and I'll say the two T-piers, our floating dock, the seal dock, the street end docks, seals just won't pay their bills, Tidelands dock, our 50-odd commercial fishing boat slips, and any of those other common public facilities which spread out anchorage area, and then the general mooring area of just the generalist boats.
You mean all mooring, all boats in the city mooring would have to have insurance, or just the city?
Well, I would think that is something that we would have, to steal a coastal commission term, original jurisdiction over, versus, and I'll just use Marina Square as an example, a boat in a Marina Square slip, the Marina Square's insurance requirement, we've leased that water and that land to Marina Square to manage, and through that lease we've put specific insurance requirements on there. We can't unilaterally go in and say, well, now you got to have more insurance for this thing or more insurance for that thing without negotiating the lease. So if the lease stipulates one thing, we're bound by the lease. So it would be my understanding that our lease sites generally would be up to manage their own insurance needs and wants.
So if Joe Dokes owns his own private mooring and keeps his own boat on there, are you saying that he needs to get insurance also?
No.
Nobody's saying anybody needs to get insurance. I think those moorings would fall under our original jurisdiction for insurance, any other sort of rules and regulations and things with the City of Morro Bay wish to pass.
Okay.
If we were to suddenly pass something that said all boats using Morro Bay facilities must have liability insurance, P&I, it would be my understanding that the moorings, with the exception of Marina Square and the Yacht Club, because they lease a block of 25 right. each, I think those two exceptions, all the rest of the moorings would be subject to that same provision.
Tom?
I just had a thought, since Gene said, so does a Yacht Club require insurance to tie up on their moorings?
What?
The Yacht Club requires insurance from our members who rent, or from anybody who rents our moorings long term. But when transients come in and tie up to our dock or use our guest moorings, they are not required to have insurance. Marina Square, I was talking to Kevin today, and they require insurance from those who are renting their slips and moorings. I don't know about Associated Pacific or State Park or the other entities around.
Gene?
So, Eric, if somebody comes in and ties up to the side tie dock, city facility, are they going to be required to have insurance?
That's another hypothetical that, and I'm going to go back on the mooring thing here a second when I answer that question. Much like, let's assume the City of Morro Bay chooses to try and require some sort of insurance of vessels using our facilities. As Lynn points out, on a long-term basis, that's a little easier to manage on a boat that just comes through for a day or two. A little more difficult to manage, so that I would think would be something we would vet through the public process if we really wish to choose to go there. I know in the meeting we had with the insurance folks the other day, and I think Alan has stated in the past when his insurance, when he goes up to other ports and stays there for a while, he gets that other port named as additionally insured while the time he's there. But that's 2, 3, 4 weeks, a month, 2 months for a day in and a day out. It would be difficult, if not impossible, to manage something along those lines. So I think that would be something to get worked out through a process. Back to the moorings for a second. You know, we do have, for folks that own their own moorings, we do have mooring rental agreements. I think that would have to, I'm going to back up a little bit in my previous statement that they would be included on some sort of blanket insurance requirement. Those mooring agreements are a contract. I don't know what they state in terms of, off the top of my head, the city's rule and regulations or municipal code. If the city passes something, that mooring agreement is a contract that has, you know, X number of conditions to it and currently doesn't have insurance on there, obviously. That's something we'd have to look into to see if that would be insurance provision be something that would fall under that contract, in other words, sort of a renegotiation, or whether a blanket insurance requirement would just fall over all those mooring owners. That's a question I don't know.
Because you don't own the ground tackle, you just own the space, or you lease the space, and the mooring owner leases the space from you.
Correct. It's like our waterfront lease sites. It's just a very small lease site.
So where do we want to go with this, folks? Do we want to think about it and table it? Or, you know, it sounds to me that I'm not sure we're prepared to make any major decision tonight, although maybe we are.
And if I can add a tiny bit more. You know, the meeting we had was, like Lynn says, it was very productive with the CJPIA, the city's insurance carrier. Looking at the list, you know, he had a couple comments on a couple items of that list of 19, but by and large, that list, if any of those things, you know, had some sort of an incident occur, we were covered by the city's insurance for that. The idea being, while we may be covered, there may be things that we want to tender to somebody else because it's their fault, even though our insurance will cover it because that person didn't have insurance. We want to tender it somewhere else if we can and minimize the cost. Back to the pier, I've given that one some more thought. I've not looked into the files. I don't know that I will. It is what it is. We took out a $2 million loan on that. Either one of a couple or three few things happened. Either it was insured and the insurance just wasn't adequate, and what the stated value of it was just not the right number. Nobody updated it. I don't know. So maybe we got $100,000 for it, but the pier cost, you know, $2.2 million. So we had to get a big loan. That may have occurred. I don't know. Or it may have been that it was insured, but the...
On an insurance basis is that if that incident happened today, you know, again, it happened before. I mean, if there was an electrical fire on a fishing vessel in a South T pier, God forbid, burnt down again, would we as a city be insured, and is it insured for $2.5 million?
Today, yes.
There, okay.
We get that list every year. We try and get it as realistic as possible with a, and as the insurance guy said, we put a replacement value on there. They acknowledge that, let's say we put $2.1 million as a replacement value for the South T pier, and it costs, you know, $2.8. It's a best effort to make sure that it's an estimate of what the replacement value. It's not an exact. It's like, okay, you only had it for 2.1. That's all we're giving you. If it costs 2.8, it's 2.8. It's true replacement value as long as it's within reason of what we had estimated it at. If we had estimated it at $100,000, obviously you're paying less for less insurance. The insurance company would take issue with that, but we make our best effort to get.
Insurance is being required. I know I've gone into ports with my boat, and I have been asked for P&I. I have also been allowed in when normally they didn't even want me to go in there because it was a wooden boat. But under some circumstances, they'll let you come in anyway. If you're going to follow the general trend, then we should probably look into requiring insurance from whoever we can influence and require it from. Personally, I dislike that. I don't know that requiring that would really do the city a whole lot of good. If you look at the history of the incidents over the last 10 years, which I got from the Harbor Department, in some of those incidences, probably the city might have recovered something, in others they would not have anyway, because the boats would fall into this category of uninsurable, or the owner doesn't want to buy insurance. They're the derelict boats that are probably going to be more problematic. Ergo, what good does it do us? Not a whole lot. But that's a personal feeling. So, you know, I'm one of seven.
Right.
So I hear you as a recommendation that we should maybe take a look at requiring insurance whenever possible in the vessels in the harbor. Is that correct?
Trend. Then that would be the conclusion.
So, okay. So if I can...
Eric?
Yeah, I'll just jump in. So, and try and make a quick summary. Maybe it'll help. So the ad hoc committee identified a number of risks, and thank you very much for all that work. It was good work. And by and large, we're covered by our insurance. The uninsurable type ones, the real derelict boats that we're trying to get at, are probably never going to be insurable. So requiring insurance of everybody else, like as Lynn says, is that going to do the tools to attack that problem? If, you know, derelict boats are never going to go away. Sometimes they'll come here that way in that state, and we've got to deal with them. Sometimes they deteriorate to that condition, and we've got to deal with them. But the bottom line is we got to deal with them. And I guess the question is insurance a tool that will prevent that from occurring? It's not a large amount. We have been, knock on wood, fairly lucky in that regard. We've had some pretty big ones, the sinking of the Susan Diane, that big wooden trawler at our pier. Fortunately, Fish and Game and Coast Guard paid for a large amount of that, but we ended up on the hook for a fair amount of that. had that boat been insured? I guess the question becomes, will insurance force an owner to maintain it better because he's got to keep it insured and keep his insurance company happy by way of surveys and regular maintenance? If he complies with that, yes. If he doesn't and he loses his insurance, the question is, then what? Okay, you're denied use of city facilities, go away. And you don't go away. We've got some of those now that people, you know, unfortunately, without a boatyard, I can't just take that boat out of the water and go stick it in a back corner somewhere out of sight, out of mind, and I don't care if the owner has got it in the water or not. He can get it out of hock if he wants to. If not, eventually it goes away. And it's less of a risk. In the water, it's a continual risk, and it gets worse and worse and worse. And, you know, so far, I've not had a lot of luck. I've had some. I don't want to discourage people out there, but we've had a very limited amount of luck of pressuring people out of town with junk boats because they've got junk boats and they just won't comply. And it's usually they aren't maintaining them for a reason. It's because they don't have the money to, and they don't have the money to pay the rest of their bills. So that's usually the route that becomes more effective.
Okay. So where do we want to go with this? Ron, do you have any comments?
Nothing additional.
Okay. So I don't know if this requires a vote. We need to take it up in the future. We can. Thank you.
And I will say there are some things from that list that are still a work in progress on staff's part. There were some recommendations in there that we have still yet to and work on following up on. So we're still got a little bit of activity going there. So it's if something comes of that, we can always bring it back up.
But I think it was a worthwhile endeavor. And thank you for all your time and effort, Lynn. And Ron.
And Alan.
And Alan. Okay. Thank you, committee. Okay, so we get the new business, the Harbor Advisory Board review and input on various existing and potential vessel best management practices in Morro Bay. Eric?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is a future agenda item from a ways back. The board wished to look at various best management practices within Morro Bay, whether it's in our rules and regulations or in the municipal code or just general stuff we like to put out there to the boaters. We did address a fair amount of this in our rules and regulations review over the last 6 or 8 months in some of the rules and regulations. So those will capture some of the BMPs that may fold into what we're talking about here tonight. We do have some BMPs and sanitation type things codified in the Morro Bay Municipal Code. Primarily they're in section 15.24, which is the vessel, quote unquote, vessel sanitation section. That's an attachment to your staff report. And then section 15.40 has a very brief mention of sewage, how you're supposed to deal with your sewage if you're live aboard. And then for the rest, for the most part, everything lives in 15.24. There's a little bit in our rules and regulations, again, that we'll address as we go with that. But so what I did with this item here tonight is I categorized BMPs, which are best management practices, things voters should and could be doing, and facilities on shore to minimize, you know, environmental pollution and damage, and be as quote unquote green as they can. Some things are serve well to be codified as actual rules that you can or can't do, and some things are just practices that are aimed to be strived at. So the six general categories, and these are by no means exhaustive or all inclusive, but they're a pretty round table look at the general categories of things that are considered as best management practices, from scrubbing your decks clean because they're dirty with bird stuff, or it's time to clean your decks and make the teak a little brighter, to fixing problems, to underwater hole maintenance and whatnot. Pretty wide category of things included in there. Sewage containment and disposal, I won't go into great detail on that. It's probably, hopefully, self-explanatory. Hazardous waste disposal, that's whether those are things generated out of maintenance or things that are generated out of general boating, you know, batteries, all sorts of other things that can be considered hazardous waste. Used oil is a hazardous waste in California. Contaminated fuel, those sorts of things. Trash and plastics, again, pretty self-explanatory, all the things that are generated as a boater. And gray water, which means things that are generated out of sink and shower type activities could be considered bilge water as well. It could be considered gray water. So what I did is I took those six categories, searched around various other ports and harbors and other Morro Bay municipal code things and other best management practice. Appreciate all the work he did, and he came up with several documents from different harbors and different organizations, and put together basically a list of BMPs for each of those six categories for just General Harbor Advisory Board roundtable and input on, with the intent on put on them in terms of does it say too much, does it say too little, and then if it's one that you think would warrant being an actual regulation, meaning thou shalt not, putting a check mark next to those, and then we'll come back at some point with our overall rules and regulations update that will incorporate what BMPs go in, and hopefully I'll have a creating an overall BMP document along with our revision of all of our dockage and other boat-related agreement materials for our boaters and our mooring holders, that when folks come to visit us, they do a little more than just sign a little card that has a few rules on the back. We're going to give them a little more comprehensive package that has BMPs and other things in it. So with that, I'll turn back over to the board and see how we want to proceed on this.
Thank you, Eric. So you heard what Eric stated. He presented a pretty good document here. How do we want to handle it, folks? Do we want to go and, starting with you, Ron, comment on anything? Go by it step by step?
I would suggest we use the sort of the approach that Eric has already laid out. We have in front of us in the staff report the 1 through 6 categories.
Correct.
I might suggest that the board take a look at each of them in turn briefly, or as lay a BMP.
Okay. So why don't we start with number one, preventing fuel and oil spills. I'll start with you, Ron. If you don't have anything to comment on, or if you feel it should be changed or whatever, then you don't need to. But or does anyone have anything to say on preventing fuel and oil spills? Gene?
I just know too many people who have portable generators out on their boats, who have, you know, tanks that are on board their boat there. I don't see how they can practically do this.
And, if you don't mind, it's your indulgence, I'll just jump in.
Yeah, Eric.
For sake of conversation, that could be fuel small portable outboard motor tanks and other equipment on land only if possible. Because it's a BMP, a best management practice. You try and do your best to do it on land if you can. If not, like you say, I mean, some people have generated, some things you just can't.
Okay. So is that if possible?
If possible, it's fine.
Okay. Lynn?
I was going to comment on this, that it says outboard motor tanks, which would mean you can fill your generator. It is enclosed within your boat. So if you spill anything, it's going to be on the boat, not into the water. That in this, you're actually looking at fueling when you're over the water. And using a funnel will solve most of that problem. So... But otherwise, yes, I agree. It's not always reasonable when you run out of gas or you run low on gas and you're outboard, you've got to put more gas in.
Yeah, especially ones in that.
That are installing, that puts it in a very secondary place. Fill outboard motor tanks on land when possible. That's, again, a possibility. Therefore, it would be lower on the checklist. But the other things, such as the use of absorbent pads, goes a long way toward helping contain small spills, and all of those should be higher on the list.
Yeah, makes sense. Duly noted.
Makes sense.
Neil?
Since these are recommendations, I guess, the fueling small portable outboard motor tanks on land, if possible, or using a spill container if possible, meaning have your gas tank in a container so that if you do spill without using a funnel, that the gas is now in your container instead of in your bilge. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but that's what we're required to do by the health department for our oyster farm, and it works out really well, actually.
Dana?
Yeah, I agree concerning the fuel tanks and portable generators and such like that. I do like this practice that Neil was just talking about with the for bigger outboards that have a separate tank in the boat. If you can have a container, I think that's a great idea. I would say A seems to be that should almost be a requirement. Just always having that absorbent pad underneath the, you know, in the bilge, because then when the bilge kicks off, at least all that oil or gas or whatever, the fuel, should be in the absorbent rather than in the water as much. I don't know. That seems to be one of the most important ones here. I like the idea of putting these in an order of importance. And then, you know, using the absorbent pad while you're fueling kind of helps take care of some of these other things, like the small portable outboards. So, yeah, I think they're all good. I guess it's good the way it is.
Okay, so basically we're going to recategorize some things from more important to less important, to a certain extent.
And I'll do that on all these categories as we go.
Okay. Okay, hearing none. Let's go on number two, cleaning and maintenance. Anyone have comments? We know we're going to go from top to bottom. Any other thoughts? Okay, Ron?
This category, when I did the review, this category brought more potential additional items to mind than the other categories. For instance, the work that we're talking about, I mean, it's this, and I'm talking about maintenance now, not just cleaning. The work we're talking about, by definition, takes place in one of two places, either on board a vessel or, as we've all seen around the waterfront, on a dock adjacent to the vessel. If the city is interested and the board is interested in containing potential pollutants, much less hazard materials from those kinds of activities, then these, you know, painting and scraping, sandblasting. What do you do with engine repair stuff? It's dripping oil or solvents or whatever it is. How do I get it off the boat to the dock? I've actually seen a fellow pick up some stuff that was dripping and carry it over the side of the boat and onto the dock, and it was dripping. So, you know, that's something to think about. One that I would suggest for consideration as being the power of the tarp has to be able to have water run off of it without, you know, wetting the surface and carrying that into the water. You might want to think of one that comes to mind is, and this came out of another set of BMPs, this isn't me talking, is for solid chemical products, chemical solutions, paints, oils, solvents, acids, caustics, and so on, including batteries and lead and copper waste, stored under cover on an impervious surface. So it can't leak through, and it's covered. That's it.
Okay.
Oh, one other thing. I like 2A, you know, as a BMP, generally over 25% of the vessel, but what I would suggest is it be a little more specific, that it say 25% of the vessel's hull topsides, A, and B, 25% of the vessel's deck area as well. There's two separate issues there.
Thanks, Ron.
Anyone else here? Neil?
Ron, did you have any ideas to address that taking off boat parts that were dripping?
Yeah. Either put them in a leak-proof, petroleum-proof bag or a tray. I mean, you got to get them off the boat. I got that.
Wear a bucket.
I like it. A
put
bucket's
it
good. Bucket's good. If it'll fit in a bucket, that's good. Sure.
Any other comments here?
Jean?
Go ahead, Lynn.
Go ahead, Lynn.
G, use minimal amounts of environmentally friendly cleaning and maintenance products. And I maybe I'm naive or silly, or but can you always believe the labels, or are specific brands better than others? I would like to see specifics named or at least recommended at some point, maybe an addendum.
So there you go. We got it. We have an opportunity to generate revenue. We can ask. We can recommend products. Product placement.
Well. I know, like West Marine. If anybody buys their products, which probably everybody does, they've got good advisory stuff sprinkled throughout their catalog that gives some of that information that kind of tells you some of these ones that are good or better. But you're right. Yeah, it says. You know, environmentally friendly. That's what the label says. That doesn't necessarily mean it is. You got to read ingredients and do a little.
So at least maybe even have them go to the website and.
Oh, you know, give them a list.
Or give them a list. Yeah. You probably have a pretty good list, Eric, right?
Good.
I don't own a boat. Personally.
Okay. Gene?
On number A, encourage major, generally over 25% of the vessel's area to be done at the boatyard. Does that per year, or, I mean, if I do 10% to this year, and next year I do another 10%, and then the following year, am I over 25%? I mean, you're maintaining the boat all the time. At some point, you will be over the 25%.
I think it's at any given time, Gene. Okay? All right.
Except in your case, Gene. Yeah. We're going to keep track.
I'm sure you are.
Yeah. Okay, so. So, anyway, number two here. So, do we have any other comments before we go over and leave number two?
And two goes over to the other side. There's I and J on the other side of the page, so don't.
And I know the commercial fishermen are using our thin vacuum sanders a lot.
Correct.
So we are trying to make an effort to keep the bay clean, and they're really coming in handy, and they work really well. They're getting a lot of use. Probably wear them out soon.
All right. Okay, then. So let's go on to number three, sewage containment and disposal. So it's pretty self-explanatory, most of the items there. I don't see anything. Does anyone see anything that should be added or deleted? Neil?
So, two things. Eric, for clarification, B, that's already a law, right?
Yeah, we talked about that
right.
In the previous meeting is in our rules and regulations. That the question of what about some of these ones that treat sewage and discharge
right.
that are legal for discharge in California, but our current regulations prohibit it, so... Yeah, that one is a definite
okay.
must-do, not a BMP.
I just want to clarify that. And then moving down to D, ensure MSD systems are working properly and regularly check that diverter, the Y, and through-hole valves are properly positioned. I'm not familiar with this because I don't have these on my boats, but if I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Y, when you're out at sea, you open the valve to go straight out to sea, any of your waste, and then when you come into harbor, it's supposed to go get closed so that it goes into a tank.
Comes up when you talk about vessels that don't have holding tanks and they just have a discharge straight to the ocean, locking the through hole becomes the issue of a safety thing where mm-hmm. you want to have, even though it's illegal to discharge, you still want to have control of that through hole in some sort of situation you need to open or close it. You'd think closing it, you know, for a leaking situation would be the thing you want to do, but there may be times when you need to exercise it open or whatever, so... But yes, for the Y-valve, it is would be potentially, could be, I don't know if they're designed, I suppose they're designed maybe to be lockable, but at least you could secure them one way or the other.
So, but for boats that do have a tank?
From the head, either to the tank or to the ocean. So you've, the one to the ocean, you'd be able to always secure closed as well. You'd be able to have control of that one. That's the important one.
Okay. I mean, is that something that there's any interest in doing? Or would that be something you guys would, or anybody else on the board has any input on or thoughts?
Well, if to strengthen it, if there was a desire to strengthen it, language would be added that Y-valves must be in, you know, the right position to go to the tank when in port or something like that.
And when we get checked by the Coast Guard to get our sticker, they check the heads.
Yeah.
And they got to be right.
So you have to have a Y-valve or you have to have it in the right position?
Well, either they suggest locking the bathroom or having a holding tank. And
anything else on number three? Ron?
Just because I observed it on G, where it says, do not allow pet waste to accumulate onboard vessels and docks, dispose of it waste properly, I would suggest adding the phrase, or letting it go overboard. And that's how I watched a guy hose it off the deck.
Don't let it go overboard.
Hose it off the deck.
Okay. No.
All right.
And I would think that would be a must. Not a try not to, but
no,
yeah.
It's a must.
You're not allowed to.
Yeah, you're not allowed
to. That falls under existing. You can't allow
it. Now, hazardous waste disposal. Gene?
Would you consider pelican poop hazardous? I have tons of it I have to scrape off. I need to know whether I'm doing it okay or not. I use a fire hose. Is that acceptable?
Okay. Bird poop's okay.
Bird shit is okay.
Dog poop.
But not cat and
not,
dog.
No.
And people.
Okay.
I'm just trying to lighten the load.
They eat fish, so I guess it's all.
Okay, anything more on number four, Lynn?
Yeah, I would suggest that it says recycle used engine oil, et cetera, et cetera. Use oil absorbent materials. The oil absorbent materials are available from the Harbor Department and they are free, and I think people should know that, and you should advertise it by adding it in here. And also, we cannot recycle. We can recycle the engine oil. The fuel filters we can turn in, but engine coolant, zinc anodes, and batteries will not be picked up by the Harbor Department.
No, we take those.
Or gasoline.
Gasoline, no.
Those which can be given to you and those that have to go
on. BMPs. So if somebody had a copy of the BMPs, they would know about those things?
If you're going to print up a sheet to hand out to everybody, I would say yes. Make it as complete without being unnecessarily verbose. And make it as simple. You will get higher rate of agreement if you do.
Okay, Neil.
Real quick, Eric, the oil absorbent pads. Would there be any possibility for the Harbor Department to dispense one with that checklist you give to everybody that they have to?
A welcome basket.
You know? Wicker.
Give them a pellet. Give them a
yeah, because a lot of guys don't know how to get fuel.
Yeah.
That's a good point here. How do you get fuel and what's the procedure? I think that's a good idea.
But most of the time you go to the fuel dock and the first thing, as soon as the guy hands you the nozzle, he hands you the diaper.
Not on our fuel dock. We don't have any.
Really?
Yes. I mean, the harbor could bring us geo some, but he never makes an effort.
Well, I mean, I think he needs to, Eric.
He does.
So.
In other places, they do.
Somebody's to get myself in trouble.
To Tom, you got an email at your house tonight. No, Eric, I think, I mean, seriously speaking, is that you should talk to our fuel dock operator and suggest. Okay. Okay, number four, anything else? Going on to number five, trash and plastics. Oh, I'm sorry, Ron.
No, it's all right.
It's not your fault. Number four, a couple of candidates for number four, and this comes out of other ports of BMPs, has to do with the use of city trash containers and dumpsters. And other ports list out some things that they don't want to see in the city city trash containers or dumpsters, like used oil, antifreeze, gas cylinders, preservatives, and batteries, and all that kind of stuff. I would recommend that as an inclusion in BMPs. If you go down and go through the dumpsters, I should say if you use the dumpsters along.
What you do in the morning, Ron?
Jeez, this is getting where Gene's keeping track over there. I know he is.
Touché.
And then maybe one, this is somebody else's BMPs, something that addresses hydraulic fluids, oily waste, and petroleum products not to be discharged into the waters of the bay or onto the surface of the land. And I know it's obvious, but it's my understanding, Eric, that the better the BMPs, the better points the city gets with various and sundry agencies that are looking over your shoulders. Is that true?
Boxes we can check that show that we're complying by education and providing this, that, and the other thing. Yeah, the more points we score and the better off we do in that certification, and that keeps regulators happy.
Okay. Thank you, Ron. Okay, so on number five, trash and plastics. Anything to add? Anything to comment on those two statements? Neil?
We can have the best management practices apply to the harbor and the boat owners, but those, and kind of the point Ron was just making about the dumpsters and what goes in them, quite frequently the dumpster right at my slip at the floating dock, just south of the South Deep here, I constantly am seeing vans and trucks pull up and dump their house waste in there, so these BMPs won't affect them. And what they put in them, whether the city's ever thought of a garbage key or keys for boat owners to the garbage, if that's too much, I don't know.
Yeah, BMPs aren't going to cover illegal dumping.
Right. A lot of times the dumpster gets...
Because we try to make the dumpsters as easily available to our users as they need to be, the public, you guys as well. But then
that's a problem.
Unless you happen to have a camera at the time.
Right. I mean, the only fix is really to fully enclose them and lock them somehow, and then slip holders, and your set of slips, that's your dumpster. And I mean, the general public does use those dumpsters to a degree. I mean, if you're walking by with an empty Coke bottle or some trash and you don't see the small can, hopefully you're going to throw it in the dumpster. But by and large, those dumpsters are intended to be for our boaters.
Well, you also have the constant trailer boats that are there, so you're not going to be able to give
so if I locked up yours, they're going to go to the launch ramp and use those.
Neil?
Yeah, I would put thought into that, locking it up, because you might cause a different problem, and that's waste. You know, there are a lot of traffic, just foot traffic there, and people could just, instead of throwing it in the dumpster,
just throw it on the ground.
Throw it on the ground, so.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, then, and we go to the last here, Graywater, number six. Again, I think maybe some recommendations on number A of the products.
Right, like we did on the whatever the other one was.
Okay. You have a question, Ron? Okay.
Eric, as it relates to Graywater and the various and sundry agencies and good and just general good practices as it relates to the environment, what are the, if you know, vanity sinks, shower, and washing machine, all of which exist on board some one or more vessels.
Which type? Safety risk? Health risk?
I don't care. I mean, I'm just trying to. I mean, it says right here. Okay, minimize production of gray water. That's B. That's 6B.
It's B.
Is that enough? I mean, does that cover as it relates to the goals of best management practices? Now, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about what, you know, trying to become the EPA by any means. I'm just talking about best management practices, because right. that's the topic tonight. Is that sufficient language for Morro Bay Harbor's best management practices? If it is, it is. If, you know.
Well, on the flip side of the coin is going to be, if it's not, what more can you do? I mean, we've got several boat owners here. I lived on a boat and produced gray water. And if I had to contain it and pump it shoreside, I'd be going ashore every day.
Well, I wasn't even going there. But how many?
What else can we do other than minimize production of it?
For instance, if boaters are going to read BMPs.
So you're looking for more of a description?
Maybe, yeah. If your boat owners, how many boat owners, and maybe it's 100%, will read BMPs or read this BMP and it says gray water? No, oh, I know what gray water is. How many of them know what gray water is?
So more of a description of gray water.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about it being more onerous requirement. I'm just talking about a little more information. If more information would be helpful.
Okay, Gene, you had something?
Yeah, the county has a definition for gray water, if you want to go by them.
Thank you.
Cool.
Okay. Satisfy you?
In relation to the amount of soap or other thing that you're putting into it, or does it make any difference?
That would be the dilution is the solution to pollution theory. I don't think so. Whatever the potentially harmful products are going overboard, it's going to be the same amount whether it goes over with 1 gallon or 10 gallons.
Whether it goes in a large volume or a small volume.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to make a difference.
Well, maybe if you have a large enough one.
Contemporary surf movie. Okay, I do apologize. So is there any other comments on gray water? We're going to put maybe a better description, i.e. from the county. And Eric, you did a good job in summarizing everything. You'll put a couple of tweaks here and there in this, and you're going to bring it back to us, or is this going to be included? And I think I do like Lynn's idea that she mentioned the last time we talked about this, and also this time. Are you going to be printing like a flyer and be giving these to?
Yeah, and
I mean, you know, a little pamphlet.
What I'm envisioning in all this, in the Muni Code and rules and regulations stuff that we've been looking at, is getting with legal and all of our legal documentation, license agreements, docket agreements, all that stuff. Putting together a whole new package for when somebody shows up, when Joe Boater shows up and ties up at the pier, or a fisherman, or somebody gives up their slip and we get a new fisherman in their slip and they sign their rental agreement. All that stuff has a package that goes with it. I want to minimize the volume just so it just doesn't end up blowing down the street or in the trash can, but providing a good, succinct amount of information that includes these BMPs and the, you know, the should do's and shouldn't do's, and put that all together as a package at some point, and I'm not going to say when because I don't want to commit to a time yet because it's a pretty onerous project. I want to circle back to the Harbor Advisory Board with the rules and regulations and best management practice stuff. So I would hope to bring back the BMP document itself, what we'd plan on providing. The license agreements and the slip agreements and that kind of stuff, I doubt I'll bring through the Harbor Advisory Board, but the rules and regulations and BMPs, I'll try and package it all as one.
And it's as an informational packet.
Yeah, and provide any final information right. that I may have, things I may have forgotten over the months that we've done it, and make sure we capture everything and then reincorporate it, and then that goes off to City Council for final approval.
All right. Sounds good. And Lynn?
Aren't most of these things included in that clean boating thing that I think, I don't know if it's the state or the NEP puts out?
You mean one of these?
Well, that was one, but there's another one that's spiral bound about 4 by 6.
Yeah, yeah. You mean
that,
one of those?
That, clean body.
A lot of it is. A lot of it is, and I'll be leaning on, which is where I leaned on for a lot of this information anyhow. I think we've customized things enough, and especially with some of the information on where to recycle your stuff and whatnot.
Well,
it's customized enough to where I think warrants us putting together our own document.
Okay.
It could be as much as just a one-page flyer, one-page trifold or a plasticized thing like this.
Okay, then, hearing none, I thank you very much, Eric. One of the things that Eric brought to my attention earlier today that we need to discuss is, as you all know, the Chumash Marine Council here in Morro Bay would like to comment on that. And they would like to use the HAB as the public forum for anyone who wants to give their opinion on pros and cons of this marine sanctuary that's being proposed here in Morro Bay. Well, what that's probably going to do is require a special meeting. And so we need to, we don't necessarily have to, but time is of some essence. I think City Council would like to give some type of recommendation to the powers to be, and they would like to use us as the body to do that. So we do probably need to have a special meeting just on that. Am I correct, Eric?
Yeah, and I'll add a little bit if I may. So the Chumash did resubmit a proposal for National Marine Sanctuary designation in our waters. It's been accepted by NOAA. It made it past the first round, which is basically your application is complete and you filled in all the boxes correctly. It's now in a 60-day review, approximate 60-day review, in Washington, D.C. to see if it warrants being placed on the inventory of areas to be considered. And this is really a future agenda item, so we can't get any discussion here. I'm just giving you the background of how we're getting here. So it's in Washington, D.C. In order for the City Council to really consider it, it's been identified that the Harbor Advisory Board is probably a good venue for that, to put together basically a public hearing along the lines of what Port San Luis did back in June. Late June was where they allowed, each side, so to speak, the pro and con of a sanctuary designation to have 10 or 15 minutes, and they had a staff report that had pertinent information on both sides of it, pros and cons, here's the upsides, downsides, and presented it, and then allowed their commission to present two resolutions, one in support and one in opposition, and the Port San Luis Commission chose to oppose. And we've identified, we meaning city staff, have identified the Harbor Advisory Board is probably the best venue in which to do that, to put together that public hearing, then whatever Harbor Advisory Board recommends, we'd pass on to the City Council. So the 60-day clock with NOAA is ticking. We're probably about halfway through it. So we're a little behind the eight ball on time, which unfortunately brings up that S-word special meeting. We do have another joint meeting with the City Council on the 29th and all the advisory boards and bodies. So we're loading up September pretty heavily, if the board wants to go there or if we want to just go with the regular October meeting.
Well, actually, I think this is probably, if we're going to have a meeting and we're going to have a forum, I think we should have a special meeting just on that. That's my opinion. I think that the real issue, like about 30 more days, and then so my point that I was trying to make is that the last time that this was proposed, we were thinking of holding a special meeting, and we were going to do the pros and cons, and then the first round got rejected.
Got kicked out.
So, like special meeting, so I guess we need to...
Exactly, and what is that? Do you know that date offhand?
The City Council meeting's upcoming, obviously one next with second and fourth Tuesdays. Next week, next Tuesday the 8th, September 22nd, Tuesday the 22nd would be the second meeting in September, and the meeting in October, first meeting in October would be Tuesday, October 13th. It's pretty late in the month.
What, would the first week in October be too late?
For a HAB?
For a special meeting.
Well, we have our normal meeting on the 1st. The 1st is actually the first Thursday in October.
I understand that.
This year.
I understand that.
So I guess the issue being is that is October 1st too late, and should we hold our regular meeting and call it and really have only one item on the agenda, which would be this? We could do that. You know, Eric?
The 1st would be pushing it.
Okay, okay. So in other words, you've been...
I don't know the exact date in October when, because I don't... I've been trying to ascertain when. So when the Western Regional Director of NOAA deemed the application complete and passed it on to Washington, D.C., I have not been able to ascertain when that was and when D.C. started their 60-day clock.
Okay.
We believe it's about mid-October.
So again, Eric, as we've tried to have special meetings in Pauley, we have to get a place. We have to publicize it. We've got to do all this stuff in advance. And if we're going to hold it before October 1st, that's probably between the 15th and the 1st. So I'm going to say that I can meet any day. I you know, just make it happen and tell us what it is, and hopefully we'll get a quorum. You know, I mean, and we need to invite, you know, you're going to need to invite the pros and cons people and publicize it and hope we get an audience, and I'm sure we will. Yeah. So that would be my recommendation, unless someone has something else, is to make it happen anytime between the 15th and the 1st. If you want to send an email out, Pauley, just to give us a couple days, or if you just want to say this is what we're going to do it, and hopefully it won't conflict with a lot of people's schedule. If we only we need five people, I believe, or four people, if I'm not mistaken. So I think we can manage to get four people.
I guess we first need to decide if we've got a consensus to do a special meeting.
Okay.
And if anybody's got any, if it's a yes, if there's any hard and fast blackouts that anybody knows about.
Okay, so let me ask a call to vote on, or does anyone have a motion to...
Time for reports to be generated that, you know, whoever's going to speak on each topic, do you think we'd...
I'll be ready.
Okay. I just want to make sure that it's effective. So, okay, there's the answer.
So, does anyone have a motion?
I'll make the motion.
Okay, Tom, you make the motion that we should hold a special meeting for the topic of the Chumash Marine Sanctuary proposal. Do I hear a second?
I'll second that.
Okay, first and second. Any discussion? Hearing none. We have all in favor, say aye. All opposed? Hearing none. So we are going to have a special meeting anytime between the 15th and the 1st. Is there anyone that has a conflict that they know right now that they cannot make it? Neil?
The whole week of the... I leave the 17th and I get back on the 27th.
So,
well, the weekend of the 14th, if something happens in that, the 14th, 15th, 16th, yeah.
Well,
tell you what.
You said the 15th would work great.
Tell you what, why don't we, between Pauley and I, we'll get with you guys individually and probably tomorrow. Let's try and get something over the weekend, look at your calendars, and we'll see if there's anything where we've got a number of people that are definitely gone. We may end up losing one or two no matter what. But
yeah, so that's a given. So, okay, so you're going to give us a call, Pauley? Okay.
Or send emails out and just
send emails.
Give us your blackout dates.
Or, yeah, why don't you, you know, it would be more beneficial, find out what the dates are available, and then,
okay,
you know, send an email out and let's respond.
Okay.
Tom?
Eric, are we going to round up the local subjects that are proposed to the for the sanctuary and against the sanctuary, like the Chumash people and
Sierra
Club and stuff like that?
I think the general idea is much like what Port San Luis did, where they had supporting and opposing factions or whatever you want to call it, present, you know, on equal terms, you know, what their proposals are and provide documentation to in the staff report in a balanced fashion and just offer it up like that and let the public comment, come and weigh in and see what the Harbor Advisory Board wants to do with it.
Is there like a certain time period that we have to give those people to respond to us?
In terms of what?
Like, if we were to tell them we were going to have a special meeting, do we need to give them 10 days or something? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't want to call something next Wednesday.
I don't think you want to do it unless they can. I think you probably need to call the Sierra Club.
Yeah, Sierra Club and the Shumash. Yeah, and see.
And the Fishermen's Association, Tom.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and make sure that they're available.
Yeah, make sure they can make it.
Yeah, yeah. We definitely want to give ample time.
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think we need to do our homework. If we need to have this before the 1st, by some chance, if we can't, then the fallback plan is to hold it the first meeting, and that will be on our agenda.
Probably.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, council will be here. It's as well, just to give you all and the public a good time.
Well, you know, it seems like you're going to be gone. You know, and it really has to be probably between the 21st and the 1st. I mean, that seems to be, because if it's the 14th, that's a little too soon, I would think. I mean,
yeah,
that's my opinion.
Yeah, that means and Monday being a holiday doesn't help either.
Yeah. So, you know, we really have 21st to the 30th.
Which gives us time to get it. You know, as far as the council goes, probably really no good practical way, unless time days get added to the month, to get it to them on the 22nd. It may be we're going to have a fallback to the 13th anyhow, but even pushing it to the first meeting in October. But we'll see if it's practical to get it through on the 14th or 15th. I've got my doubts, but. And it's not to say, I mean, just because I'm gone, it doesn't mean we can't hold it.
Well, you just have to have your second in command, Becca.
Yeah.
Come here and do it.
Or Lori.
Okay?
So
or Lori.
Like I say, I'm not going to preclude it just because I can't be here. I
mean, right.
It's really a hearing, and the staff report I'll get written up no matter what. It's not going to take a lot of guidance from staff.
Well, I think, it, you know, again, is that if we're doing this before the city council and the first, and then you have a council meeting on the 22nd, and the next one is not until the 8th, is that correct?
13th of October.
Okay, so we either have to do it before the 22nd, or we probably do it at our regular meeting.
Yeah.
I mean, those would be the only two choices.
I mean, insofar as the Harbor Department, if I understand it, I mean, it's basically, in this case, they have an administrative task to do, which is to prevent a staff to prepare and present a staff report. That's it. I mean, you guys aren't involved in the issue.
Right. No.
Right.
No.
Yeah, so Eric's point's well taken, which is any member of the Harbor Department can present the staff report. Yeah. So.
So why don't you just see what you want to do, give us an email, and tell us what date would be preferable.
Yeah, what we've done here with, you know, with this motion, 15 to the 1st, that gives me a great window.
Yeah.
We'll work as best we can within that and talk to Fred and the Shumash and the Sierra Club and Fishermen's Association and see what we can squeeze in here. And if it ends up getting pushed to that first meeting in October, it goes to the first meeting in October.
Okay.
Is what it is.
Thank you. Okay, so future agenda meetings. Does anyone have anything to discuss that is pertinent that you feel that we? I stated some things today on that. Best management practices, HAB review, which we I think went over a little bit today. Sublease slip rate discount for qualified commercial fishermen on list. That's something that I believe Joe brought up in regards to, that's on the thing. Eelgrass mitigation co-op by city, which is, probably something that, you know, is in the forefront now, and especially after we heard the presentation by the about something like that. So that might be something that we should talk about. Neil?
And just to add to that, maybe as it reads, it's Eelgrass Mitigation Co-op by City, but there might also be some status update and invite the NAP and possibly even invite somebody from Newport to speak to how their progress has worked.
Mr. Chairman, I after Saturday, I reached out to Adrian Harris, who's the issues that relate to eelgrass and water and waterfront development and maintenance, and she's working on that. So that's another piece that, if as Neil says, she's invited, or I should say NEP is invited, they might be able to present that at the same time.
And on that, Morro Bay Fish Quota, which we just heard tonight, a good presentation by Andrea. Inspecting marine sanitation devices on all vessels in the Morro Bay Harbor. And planning for the power plant property. Those are the things that are on our future agenda items. Does anyone have anything that needs to be added, subtracted, or discussed? From what I understand is that we have been mandated by City Council to try to get and enter into negotiations on master lease with the state. Eric is actually the head person that's working on that. I don't know where he is on that process. Maybe, I don't know if you can comment on it right now.
Yeah, well, that would be a location, nothing to report. Planning for power plant property, nothing to report. We're all kind of in holding patterns on all that, waiting on other things to unfold.
Okay.
Is there any reason for the Harbor Advisory Board, based on what you know today, to become involved in the next 2 to 3 months in the State Park Marina situation?
Not at this point. I think if something evolves out of our current actions and activities, I'll work with your chairman and make sure we get things in front of the HAB when they come forward.
Okay. Does anyone have anything to add or would like to move forward? If not, I'll work with Eric in making sure that we do have a packed agenda pertinent to the needs of the harbor. With that, do I hear a motion to adjourn? I have Lynn.
Seconded.
And we have a second with Dana. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Good night.